Before we begin properly, can I just ask for you all to check that all mobile phones, pages, small children are all switched off before we start the reading and everything. Thank you. And just to explain briefly what's going to happen this evening, if you've not been here before, after a brief introduction, A.L. Kennedy will be doing a reading from her forthcoming short story book, Indelible Acts. Following that, there'll be a question and answer session, and during that time, if you have anything that you'd like to ask, just raise your hand and we'll get to you very quickly. Following that, Alison's very kindly agreed to do a signing session outside. So if you've got any books that you'd like signed, then come across. And if you don't have any books, they're on sale outside for you as well. Okay. Well, A.L. Kennedy is a world-class fiction writer. That's not according to me, that's according to the New York Times. According to The Guardian, however, she's radiantly well-scrubbed. Well, whichever of the above, or all of the above, Alison is certainly a multiple award-winning writer and an incredibly prolific wordsmith. In barely over a decade, she has produced 3 full-length novels, a novella, 3 collections of short stories, 2 non-fiction books, 3 stage plays, 7 television scripts, a feature film script, Stella Does Tricks, and numerous columns in The Guardian. On the way, she's gathered a loyal list of fans that includes Salman Rushdie, Jonathan Coe, A.S. Byatt, and Richard Ford. To go a little further back, Alison Louise Kennedy was born and grew up in Dundee. She went to Dundee High School, where she first gained her love of reading, primarily at that time, plays and poetry. She then came to do a BA in theatre studies and drama here at Warwick University. And she returned about 4 years ago for a term to come here as a visiting lecturer. During that time, she was frantically cornering anybody in the English department, asking what they knew about matadors and bullfighting. Anybody who said Ernest Hemingway was given very short shrift. Apparently, he's incredibly inaccurate. But following that, of course, the great non-fiction book on bullfighting appeared. Alison is a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts. She has been a Booker Prize judge. She's currently a judge of next year's Orange Prize and was a judge of the Guardian First Book Award last year. Alison currently lives in the city centre of Glasgow, and before she writes, she takes off her shoes. Now, Alison has a very distinctive fictional voice, as many of you, I'm sure, are aware. It's often austere, it's emotionally loaded, and her non-fiction, while sharing many of those traits, is also confessional and stark. The Dictionary of Modern Literary Biography lists as common themes in her work depression, loneliness, paranoia, suicide, prostitution, child abuse, infidelity, wife beating, sadism, sexual fetishism, and mental breakdown. In for a treat tonight, ladies and gentlemen. But all of this actually belies what is a tremendous wit and flashes of magical realism that pervade throughout her work, along with the hopeful, cynical romances that are a consistent theme. Although featuring often in lists of great contemporary Scottish writers, Alison's work very deliberately is against the grain of traditional Scottish culture. Her first work, and her first award came along with it, was the short story collection Night Geometry and the Gaskadon Trains, which I think was begun while you were a student here, is that right? A little bit after. Maybe a lot after. Following that, other high-profile books included Now That You're Back, Original Bliss, So I Am Glad, and the latest book, Everything You Need. All of her works have met with high critical acclaim, but she never ceases to experiment with language and with form. The rest of this year promises to be an extremely busy one for Alison. She's going to New York and to Canada and to Hungary for readings, is doing another teaching class in Calvados, I think. Before the launch of her next book, from which we're hearing an extract this evening, Indelible Acts, which will be published by Jonathan Cape this autumn. Alison delivered the prestigious Penn Lecture at the Edinburgh Book Festival last year, and it's a small extract from that that I'd like to finish this introduction. Fiction, she said, provides truth, the truth that we are all more than what we seem, and that what each of us holds is irreplaceable. Ladies and gentlemen, the irreplaceable Alison Kennedy.
It's Very nice. The infinitely replaceable, I think. Yes, well, I'll try and be moderately offensive rather than dragging you through an awful lot of fetishism and violence. We'll just do a bit. I'll read from the beginning of one story and the whole of another story, and if you are offended by offensive things, go away now. Or stay, with that strange smile that I always see in the audiences that I get. That's nice. And I would point out, I was a student here, and I didn't have to repay a loan, or I wouldn't have been a student here, because I couldn't have afforded it. So that's interesting. I don't think there's anything else I have to say, really. This, because I'm only reading the beginning of it, it's set in a cheese queue. The cuisine of Scotland has improved a great deal since I was young, which is not difficult, but we're still quite excited by speciality cheese shops. They're a bit wild and wacky and attractive for us. So this is, the beginning of it is set in the queue for the one speciality cheese shop in Glasgow. There used to only be one in Edinburgh. Now we have at least three in the whole country. And it's great, because we don't have that. When I was growing up, not to be offensive, but the colour of your orange pullover, it's nice dating with the orange pullover, which is a very nice colour for a pullover, not a good colour for cheese, though. That's the only colour of cheese that we had, was that slightly radioactive-looking stuff. And it melted very badly, like sort of plastic. But it is a splendid colour for a pullover. Please buy my books, don't hate me. It still turns up occasionally. I took a Spanish scene designer to lunch, and she ordered a baked potato and cheese because she had jet lag or something, or a death wish. And it arrived with this orange stuff on it, all congealed into a little hat that she couldn't get through, on a raw potato with a burnt bottom, and she sort of said, why do you hate me? No, we don't hate you. It's just that's the food that we're used to eating. But now things are much better, as I say, and we can buy goat's cheese and cheese that smells funny and Irish cheese and all kinds of cheese. And other than that, yeah, I don't think there's anything else you need to know. It's called Spared for reasons that are way too complicated for me to explain, and because it goes on to page 26 and you're only getting up to about 10. But there we go. And it's from a male perspective. The next one will be from a female perspective for balance. Things could go wrong with one letter. He knew that now, just one. Actually, I moved here 10 years ago. He'd found it so terribly, pleasantly, effortless to say, actually, I moved here 10 years ago. There had only been a little thickness about the M, a tiny falter there that might have suggested a stammer, or a moment's pause to let him total up all those years. Nobody listening, surely, would have guessed his intended sentence had been, actually, I'm married. In the course of one consonant, everything had changed. He'd been standing in the cheese queue. His bright idea to visit the cheese shop, the specialist, even though such places annoyed him and made him think there was too much money in the world being spent in far too many stupid ways, he had gone to the purveyors of nothing but cheese and things cheese-related to buy something nice for Christmas, a treat. Of course, 30 other people had been taken with the same idea and were lined right through and out of the shop and then along the pavement, all variously huddled and leaning away from the intermittent press of sleety rain. There was an awning, but it didn't help. And at that point, he should simply have gone home, but for no particular reason, he did not. Instead, he stood and turned up his collar and peered, like everyone else, into the cheese shop window, where the cheesemongers, busy and vaguely smug, trotted about in white Wellingtons, white jackets, white hats. The fact that he personally didn't much like cheese, that his gloves were back, safe and warm, in the car, that any wait here now would be quite ludicrously dismal, none of these disturbed him. On the contrary, they seemed perversely satisfying, a rare chance to perform an unpleasant task that was wholly of his own choosing. his satisfaction, had quite reasonably produced a happy kind of pressure in his chest, which had caused him to turn and say, really, to no one, they look like dentists, don't they? And then to smile. Yes, dentists, or maybe vets, cheese vets. And he'd been mildly aware of a girl in a shop window smoothly drawing down a wire and opening up the white heart of something or other with one slice, but mainly there'd been this woman standing behind him in the queue, this woman he had never met. And then there'd been this thought which had said very softly but unmistakably, my God, she has a wonderful voice. This thought which had seemed just as confident and hungry as he'd always meant and never quite managed to be. Although truthfully, what it said wasn't really right. She had a perfect voice. He could almost hear her now if he concentrated, lying awake, as usual, awake, and grinning like a nightlight, because he could imagine the flavor of her maybe and her yes. His right arm, the one that was furthest from Karen in their bed, the one that was his least matrimonial arm, was crooked up to let his wrist settle in nicely under his head and make him at least a comfortable insomniac. He was trying to breathe as if he wasn't conscious, wasn't turning helplessly inside his kicking mind, wasn't opening and closing his eyes between one type of blank and another to see which was best as a background for the image of a woman who wasn't Karen, who wasn't in any way his wife. Dark coat, mainly dark with water, but also sensible and warm. His mind now slipped away to thoughts of silky linings, but he pulled it back. A golden-coloured scarf that covered up her chin, he did like that. And then one of those horrible hillwalker's fleecy hats, which in this case looked fantastic because it was hers. She was wearing it. He had been immediately, impossibly, mortally charmed. The truth of this made a brief swell in his breathing, followed by a sigh. Greg, please. By which Karen didn't mean, Greg, please torment me with your luscious manhood now and for the rest of the night until I speak in tongues. She meant, half asleep but still determined, she always was determined, Greg, please, either fall asleep now or go to the spare room and give me peace because I've got to get up for work tomorrow morning just as early as you do. So, like a dutiful and undisturbing partner, he slid out of bed onto one braced arm, one knee, and then staggered softly up into a standing position and took himself away. This had happened before the cheese queue, this type of midnight banishment. Greg hadn't really slept well in months. The muffling of the pillow at his ears could very easily make him picture coffins, and drowsiness often produced a sensation of morbid, jerked descent, as if into a curiously sticky grave. He suffered from nocturnal sweats. By the time he had joked to Karen over breakfast that fixing up a variation on a Victorian casket alarm might help keep him calmer, she hadn't found his difficulties funny. He had tried, although he was extremely tired, to be more playful, to expand the idea, suggesting that he really should tie one finger with thread in the hope that his subconscious might believe itself safely connected to the brand of handy little bell designed in a more cautious age to prevent premature burial. You should try the pills again. Break the cycle. The pills made me sleep in the daytime. I can't keep being discovered in the office with my head on the desk. People will end up thinking I have a life. This said, in a self-deprecating and not vicious way, but all the same, you do have a life. It's just not compatible with mine. This said, in a way that was a little light-hearted, but with eyes that fixed him for a threatening moment before she went to turn over the toast. We should get a toaster. I'll get one. You'll forget. You always forget. I'll get one. Tomorrow. Can't today. Mm-hmm. Greg loathed the way she did that, closing everything off with her favorite passive-aggressive little noise, the agreement that didn't agree. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In other places, though, other times, it was a good sound to make. In that other time, that other place, it had been the best. Mm-hmm. They could be vets, couldn't they? Yes. He settled his limbs out in the chill of the spare bed and recalled the horrifying pause when the conversation might have faltered, stopped, and left him to the cue, let his head go sliding under, back into the fetid sump that held his nights and days. He'd known, in a way that made his ears ache, that he hated his shoes, his not waterproof shoes, and that his latest haircut had been shoddy and would look especially dreadful when it was wet, and that naked drips of rain were clinging just exactly where they shouldn't on his face, like unwanted earrings, tears, snot. But he kept himself steady. He'd raised his chin, broken his very personal gloomy surface and stolen a breath, and blinking into her face, he'd understood that this whole situation might possibly, conceivably, turn out fine. He might come to be as he would like to be without breakages or loss because she was smiling, smiling only at him. Greg's hands scrambled for his pockets and a fraying tissue that rapidly transformed itself into a greyish wad. Christ, what a day. And he mopped his face while praying sincerely that he wouldn't sound so cretinous the next time he opened his mouth. Yes, but it'll be worth it. And he did realize she was talking about the cheese, simply saying that the bloody cheese would be worth the wait, but still he felt himself swallow, need to hold one hand in the other, and couldn't help stumbling back with, yes, it will, I hope. No, it will, naturally. Yes. Before coughing out a remarkably ugly and, in God's name, unmistakably equine laugh. I don't suppose any of us come here normally, it's just Christmas, isn't it? So is she celebrating Christmas for herself or for somebody else who is with her, who is allowed to touch her face? It can't be absolutely just Christmas. Don't contradict her. What the fuck are you doing? I mean, do you want her to be pissed off? They must get some customers sometimes. They stay open. Oh, that was scintillating, wasn't it? Well, fucking done. Maybe they're only a front for the CIA. God, thank you, God. Now that you mention it, I did see them shoot this shoplifter once. Execution style with a silenced gun? Absolutely, extremely professional. Oh, well then, that's that. Definitely CIA or MI5. I want to lick her now. The rain from her eyes, just to lick. Do you think we should still let them have our money? Yes, but only if they give us cheese. They were properly established then, talking about the absurdities of Christmas, about tropical holidays neither of them would take, about the concept of cheese, which, if you thought of it, was a strange one. I mean, cheese. You couldn't have come up with that by accident. He felt warmer. He felt taller. He felt fate snuggling round him with a good, good plan. Cheese. His tongue moved in his mouth especially deftly, as if each word were more than usually intended. But who would have thought to try and make it? Who would have known how? I know it's like bread dough with yeast or meringues, especially meringues. Who on earth could have guessed that would happen to an egg white if you pummeled it enough? I think the correct term is beat, while he thought, but pummel would do, I'm sure. Really could do nothing but think. There must have been a lost meringue age. That egg white looked so much like spunk, was so much like spunk. Spunk, there wasn't anywhere his mind was unwilling to go. He was so happy to follow it, it scared him. I wonder what she sounds like when she comes. The meringue age. She patted his forearm quickly, approvingly. Of course, the lost meringue age, an era of peace and random food experiments. I will know what she sounds like. I will be there, and I will hear her, and I will see. I have to. But no harm done, only thinking. His eyelids had closed, and he couldn't quite coax them back apart. Under her knee, in that curve, there would be sweat, and in between. Your accent, by the way, if you don't mind my asking, where are you from? Greg finally eased his eyes open, peeled up a muzzled guess at the shape of her thighs, of her arse, laid naked for his hand, and he saw her face. She met his gaze, seemed to take it from him, whole, while he tried to organize a sentence. My accent? Well, I used to live in England. Ah, English, as I suspected. And you haven't been here long? A brief knot of conscience and impatience lashed open at the base of his brain, and before he could stop himself, he told her, "Actually, I moved here 10 years ago, which wasn't exactly a lie. After which there'd been no stopping, no space in his will for even a pause. By the time they'd made it inside the shop, he'd known it was safe to play, make a little rehearsal, pretend that he was shopping with a girlfriend, a sexual partner, a woman who would never look revolted if he asked her to suck him, who would never clatter him with her molars in little bounces of mute revenge, and then swallow what he surrendered as if it were only cruel and unusual and not a part of him. Shopping with Karen was hardly exciting either. It was like shopping with himself, only slower and more expensive. It was one of the things they did together which had at no time ever been any fun. That day in the queue had been different, though, that day when he'd gone shopping with somebody new. This is silly. What is? She'd been almost leaning against him while the cheesemonger cut 2 pieces each of their choices, one to keep and one to swap, which is what they'd decided. What silly. Greg had dipped his head and spoken close as a kiss beside her ear because this was appropriate under the circumstances and because he'd hoped that she might like it. That we've talked for ages, about half an hour, and now we're buying cheese together, which is a very personal thing. She was joking and not joking. He liked that. He loved that. This is the way you seduce someone, isn't it? Who could have guessed I'd remember how? And this is the time to do it, maybe the last chance to try. Yes, extremely personal. And now Greg wasn't joking at all. But we don't know each other's names. That can't be right. He angled near again, made it soft. Can it? Amanda. Really? That's great. Because he'd been rushed by the lunatic fear she might be called Karen or something like Karen. Wonderful! Not that anything was like Karen. Why? Oh, I don't know, it suits you, kind of idea. I'm Greg. Say my name. So now we know each other. That's good. Say my name. Greg. Okay. Great. Amanda was waiting for a 1/4 pound of olives. He didn't like olives, but she was free to. When he asked her, "Look, I don't know your phone number either. Do I?" Which was speeding the process more than he ought, but he'd have to go home soon. He was practically late now. Saturday's dinner already supperating in the microwave, no doubt. "It's just that I would like to take you and have a coffee." "To take me and have a coffee?" "Well..." He watched her mouth. "Yes, I like coffee. Only I can't now. I have to go out tonight with no one." "Good mouth, wonderful mouth. But I have to go out, and so if I had your number, I could phone. It's the gentleman who phones, isn't it? I have got that right." Greg hadn't intended this should make her laugh, but believed it to be a splendid thing when she did. "The gentleman? So you're a gentleman?" He checked her eyes. "At times." She paused for precisely long enough to please him very much. "Okay. And I'll leave them there." Primarily because as they're in a story that I've written, it all goes horribly wrong almost immediately. Because I come from a Calvinist country and you're not allowed to have fun, especially involving dairy produce. It's wicked and evil. So there we go. I also have this rule that nobody has more fun in my stories than I do in my life, so... So they all suffer interminably. I'll read the whole of this and then I should probably stop. It's not any more offensive than that one was, probably. But I feel I have to keep up the image of Scottish writing. In that sense, I'm not going against the grain at all. It's interesting, in America, which is not interesting at all, actually, I'm just filling in time. But in America, the interminably long novel has just come out, which is full of filth and depravity and bad words and wasps. And it had this sort of good review in the Christian Science Monitor, which is apparently quite an influential literary reviewing paper, which is quite strange. But they sort of liked the writing, but they kept saying, despite the filth and depravity and the utter moral redundancy of everything and the fact that she's going to hell, it was really quite good. So I don't know if it would make you read it or not, because it didn't make all of the sins sound very interesting. It just made it sound very bad for me. It wasn't like exciting sin. It was just sin, which again is probably symptomatic of something. This is from a female point of view, as I say, for balance. Sometimes the protagonist is female, sometimes they're male, sometimes it doesn't matter, so I don't tell you, which really annoys some people. Or they think I have told them. It's great. There are some ones where there isn't a gender, and it's like, no, definitely. It's like, no. Or there's one where the guy was a guy, and it's like, no, must have been a woman. No. But that's my fault for not being clear, because the reader is always correct. It wasn't difficult. That's nice. Very nice. Anyone could have done it. Absolutely anyone. Just the way I like you. Great. He'd been applying the usual friction, first and second fingertips. Now the right. The circular rub and flicker, insisting against cloth, until both nipples caught at his attention, perked and ached, the way they would. Good. His lips slackened, moist, while his interest hid in the dumb black of his glasses. Very good. Laurie paused next, smiling, satisfied, happy my needs were symmetrically prominent. Nice. But anybody with hands could have done as much. Not even hands, necessarily. Hand would have been enough. Or a halfway decent prosthetic. Even a properly placed domestic pet. Laurie wasn't working miracles. He was not involved with raising up the dead, only a little prickle or two of extremely erectile flesh. Brush or fluster them, breathe at them, kiss, and they'll button up tight. They'll crest. Within their particular limits, the more you choose to find them, the more they'll be to find. That's how they work. Their inclinations are naturally salient. I can't do a thing to change them, and neither can he, not fundamentally. A simple chill can prick them, as can that certain monthly tenderness, and then I'll be edged near precisely the same old slip of wet intentions he rubbed me to. Traffic coughed and worried in the road beside us. Pedestrians passed, among them a higher than average number of priests. Or just men in cassocks. I'm not an expert, I can't say. And I wanted very simply to pummel Laurie onto his back and in some way secure him, then cut him out naked at the waist and suck him until both his balls were small as raisins, until he cried. Because such impulses are irresistibly instinctive, they can't be helped. Primed past the point of caring by no matter what or whom, I will react entirely predictably, like the leopard with the zebra, like the lobster with the pot. I am part of nature's usual arithmetic. I do often try to remember this in order to build perspective, an independently distant view. Four nuns pattered by, their faces a little unlikely, surprised to be marooned in wimples. My breath barked against my sternum, abrasively needy, while social convention and mental discipline struggled to keep me from arrest. I said nothing, did nothing, only seethed, as might have been expected, queasy with lust. Laurie grinned, knowingly unscathed. You like it just as much as I do, don't you? But not now. The day basted the avenue pleasantly, foreign monuments roiling under a classical sun, and the Colosseum dark at Laurie's shoulder, a monstrous hoop of decay. Why not now? Because people are looking, people will see. Then you shouldn't have worn that blouse, that's why they're looking. Of course they'll see. Don't you like men? Shush. People enjoying themselves, can't tell. Don't you like men staring at your tits? I do, because they can't have you, because you're mine. because you're mine. It's a standard wording, fits any mouth. I would have liked to turn it back on him, set my voice kicking in his chest, arcing that customary charge of hopefulness between the stomach and the throat. I would have liked to make it clear that because you're mine, I will stand in the midst of clergy, stiff with the thought of your foreskin, bitten back. Because you're mine, I will be with insufficient warning, simultaneously furious, beguiled, delighted, affronted, murderous, and cheap. Because you're mine, I will watch you the way that I'm watching right now and remember that I can strip you full down to the pink, the quick. I know you at least as well as you know me, because you're mine. It's a standard wording, not dependent upon truth. He's pacing now, almost trotting round the walls, being interested about foundations and seating arrangements and herringbone brickwork as displayed in flights of steps. He has an enthusiasm for constructions I find I cannot share. But this is not a problem. I can sit here and write my letter while he prods about. And I can look at him moving through shudders of heat, the firmness of his shadow stretching snug beneath him. He should wear a hat, really. By this evening he'll have burned. Laurie can be very cavalier about that kind of exposure. I tend to be more careful because I have good skin. Most women of my age and younger, I wrote this a while ago, have fine lines and visible wrinkles, but I don't. I have elasticity and bloom. I catch myself sometimes in the mirror when I'm alone, and there it is, my beautiful outside. The ghosts of his hands still across it from the afternoons and evenings he's spent examining, testing flexibilities. I give him my best, and he does appreciate it. He does take the time to say. I also give him my collaboration, my consent, my long bank holiday weekend to pack up and use in a curtained and mirrored hotel room in the moist ecclesiastical heat of Rome. Since we flew in last night, we have transgressed without dispensation, hourly, perhaps because no one who matters is here to see. I could, for example, cross to him now, take his hand, stroke the blue push of veins at his wrist, and wriggle our palms together in an unmistakably familiar, casual, mutually affectionate and incriminating way that any malign observer could use against us. But this is a safe city. We have left Greenwich Mean Time and entered anonymity. This makes Laurie happy, I can tell. His shoulders have a buoyancy about them I only normally see at night. In the dark, he unfolds, relaxes, takes me outside, moves me up and down pavements we can't share with any kind of comfort in open day. Or else he goes out driving. And I choose to come along, be where he takes me. Here? Why not? That time we were in a field. Lots of fresh air. Healthy. It's quiet. There's no one around. But his eyes still flickered across the windows, checking. Although he enjoys observing, Laurie never wants to be observed. He has a fear of being cornered or forced into actions he won't wish to take. No interruptions, hmm? I noted the bluey green of sheep's eyes reflecting far off to the right. It's raining, so you'll get wet. He put on the handbrake and he turned the engine off, and we sat in his car in the overcast dark of the field. No stars. On other nights he might have picked the forest or the underground office car park. I removed my Macintosh, kept on my shoes, high heels, impractical over the stubble of wheat. Oh yes, just what the doctor ordered. Let me see though, let me really see. Because I wished to do so, needed to do so, had waited to do so, because this is a choice that I can make, I stepped out and crossed the shorn rows to show him my skin. The bright burn of me flared in the headlamps, gleaming with drizzle, and the moving, and then moving, extinguishing under him. You're a very naughty girl. Held safe between him and his car, I could feel his gloves against my spine, the thin chill of a zip, the tongue and groove of our mutual interest, of us being us together, our recoiling fit. I turned my head and could watch the blisters of rain on the bonnet shiver and split, a dim shining level with my eye. He could have been anybody. Lift your arse. But he was Laurie, working me tight with a smooth negation of all other possibilities. I was glad of him, his cover, his cloth heat. My mother had often warned me against night air and stormy weather and being caught without a coat, which made another reason to let Laurie catch me and, in a sense, lend me his. Good girl. Anticipation faded into the sink of earth, the vague scent of animal shit and wet wool. He pressed my breath into fits and starts and came, as always, silently, in a ragged burst of motion and then stillness, withdrawal. He's taught himself to be thoroughly secretive, which is why I've learned to read his body and his things. This afternoon I can tell he is contented, easy. He doesn't push at his hair too much or tug his ears, and there is something liquid in his stride, a muscular amusement, a tiny swing of appetite. He's dressed to be comfy, but not unattractive. I saw him warm, freshly woken maybe 7 hours ago, picking the right things and strolling between the wardrobe and the bed, naked in a way that made my gums hurt, made the palms of my hands start to twitch. I am designed to experience these feelings. They are hardwired through my whole anatomy. I consider types of insulation, circuit breaking, but every time he trips the switch and seems to prove I couldn't end this, that anything else would be inadequate. Today, for example, he has equipped himself to show that he is happy and to jumpstart my skull. White boxers, the pair I bought him, and his oldest jeans, because we both know they hang well and make it look more than likely that he does too. And in the plain black t-shirt to set off the linen jacket for thumb hooking over his shoulder, and the Ray-Bans for making sure that he won't need to squint. And there he is, my Laurie, all tooled up. Back at home, he'll leave clothes with me, accessories, bits and bobs, small records of his scent and shape. Leather is most eloquent. His belts roll where they've taken the curve of his back and notch to mark the pressure of his waist. His shoes and gloves reform against his movements and his sweat. And of course, I do the same. In his absence, the pattern of his previous needs sings out on me. He's oiled into the grain of my fingers the way any habit would be. It is unsurprising that at night I can find his memory shunts me into sleeplessness. I haven't tried to sleep in Rome yet, not yet. It has seemed unnecessary. Fatigue occasionally dives at me, unsteadies reality, but I won't give in. I am going to stay more than conscious because Laurie is all here with me, leant over the railing, nicely taut and shifting, my encyclopedia. Before we leave, before it's over, I'll know his arms by heart, from the short clip of his fingernails to the paler and paler tenderness of his joints, the soft rise of hair. Anyone can concentrate, stay alert, for only 4 days and 3 nights, when they're constantly accompanied by the body they've learned to miss. I'm always greedy for what I know I'll lack. Of course, this rationing and waiting will tend to breed intensity in us both. Tell me where to aim it. The accumulated discomfort of over-rehearsed desire. Or I'll just put it where I want. In Rome, I'm moving from the bite of his imagination to his everyday coughs and whispers, his small breaths when he's reading, and the way he towels his hair. Each part of this is as addictive as I'd guessed, as hard to walk away from or to fight. I'll put it where I want it. You know where I'll want. I'm more used to the short nights when we're trying to impress. They were when I pushed for something to stay with me while he did not, for marks, for brands in the memory, indelible acts. I have in the past been anxious to experiment with error and trial, squatting or standing or bending or lying in my bath. That's where I want, right there and there. Laurie, the not unpleasant smell of it, slightly bitter, grassy, hot. Laurie, could you what? Well, it isn't erotic. He was standing, unfastened, braced. I'm pissing on you. How can that not be erotic? He rubbed through his fringe with his free hand. It's maybe just warm. More relaxing than anything. Sorry. It's not erotic. His flow relented, sputtered, stopped, not at all. Sorry. He sat on the edge of the bath with his back to me, set his hands on his knees to lean forward and away. No, don't be sorry. It was good to try. Yeah. He looked at his watch. I really don't have time now for anything else. I hate Laurie's watch. Resistant to many varieties of highly unnatural shock and proofed against pressures and waters at hideous depths, it will almost certainly outlive us. It pecks through our time together, unrelenting. It's his conscience and my limit, and I wish he'd agreed to just leave it in our room. I don't want to be reminded of when we'll stop. I don't want to be sad yet and have to tell him why. I want to keep collecting and making his inventory complete without distractions. When I go home, he'll have soaked my recollection. My blood will smell of him. I will think with his voice and be able to be alone, to be with other people, and to comfortably keep in mind all I'll need of him. I do hope that eventually this could be true, that Laurie could come to be anyone, the next one, someone new. He's craning over. He shouldn't do that. It leaves the skin between his hair and his collar bared to the sun. He's tender there, sweet to kiss, and this is not what he does. Something repeatable, replaceable, easy to find again. This is what he is. This is the unrepeatable, irreplaceable, unforgivable man I've had to do without for years, holding on, numb between installments of whatever his household arrangements allow him to give. This is the best he can bring me. It's what should have stopped us becoming ridiculous. This should have prevented the evenings full of ice cubes and safety razors and fruit and all the other variations on our theme, a little sting of toothpaste, a little KY dip, escalating restraint. Dirty girl. No, you're the one that's dirty. Dirty old man. He only grinned, untying me, showing he'd taken no offense. No, you're the one. You're the one, and you're going to prove it. Go and get that thing. I want to see. Show me how you're bad. Playing while I'm away. People at work bought it for me. But use it? Yes. I fetched it through for him, still in the box so he could unveil it. Fuck. My implement was longer, fatter, unmistakably larger than his. Which should have been of no significance to him. At least a couple of inches were there just for grip. They weren't a requirement. They didn't establish a level of need. He turned it in his hands like a condensed adultery. Fuck. But I don't think he ever considered not using it. All right then. All right. The dark of his eye, cold, mirroring my skin. You always want things to remember. Well, all right. And I do remember, absolutely clearly, the moment when the pain of his being there exceeded the pain of his having to leave me be. Laurie and I, we don't discuss that night. It's our other secret. We don't tell. But I find more and more that I write out what happened, what happens, in letters I never post. Letters to a wife I do not know. Although we must have a few things in common, that's what I'd suppose. We must both look at him walking in sunlight and find him beautiful. Yep.
Thank you. I'll begin if I may. You mentioned actually yourself how a great deal, in especially in your short stories, is left ambiguous or is not told to the reader. It always seems to me that in your stories that it's the thoughts, the events, the consequences are all based around the relationship between people rather than anything that they're doing themselves independently. How much do you find context and even the time it's set in plays a part, if you feel that's true at all?
It really varies. Depends what the type of story is. If it's got a lot of plot, then the plot is important. But normally there isn't one, so they're trying to disguise the fact that it's missing. But that varies from... I'm always fond of my people. I mean, as you were saying, I'm doing a lot more television, and I'm still fond of the people. I try and engineer situations that are out with the form that we're meant to be working in, just so that they can talk to each other. It's sort of like having friends that you know would like each other. You try and engineer that they would meet. So yeah, I mean, I like my people, although I do horrible things to them. It's a sign of affection.
And certainly in the first book, Night Geometry and the Gascon Trains, the people seemed, their relationships seemed in a far more advanced stage than in the later books. There seemed more hope at the beginning of the story. And is that something you're aware of? Or, I mean, what changes are you aware of in your writing as you've gone on?
I don't read me, so I'm not really. I'm surprised they've got less hopeful for it. I always think of the first book as being very unhopeful.
Sorry, that's what I was trying to say. Is
yeah, it, no, no, they, yeah, it's very black. I don't know why that would be. I mean, I had no way of earning a living, and I had a degree in theatre studies and dramatic art, which is lovely, but not very much use. And just, you know, living. I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I was writing these little tiny stories. And I mean, there's a huge amount of anxiety in them. If I'm forced to look at them now, I had to read one out a while ago in a situation like this. It was horrible because the rhythm is just doesn't work at all. But there's an awful lot of anxiety, which is just to do with the fact that I'm aware that I'm on a kind of tightrope covered in barbed wire. I think I'm going to fall off, which I've continued to be aware of, but I care less.
Are there any questions? Well, while you're thinking, if at any point you have one, it's the one at the back there. So.
With most of the non-fiction, it's people say, would you write about X, Y, and Z? With that was part of the BFI sort of little series, or it's not a little series, but a series of little books about where one writer is asked to write about a particular film. There were a number of films that I would have volunteered to write about quite happily, but they've been taken. but Powell and Pressburger were there. I might not have necessarily taken The Life of Death of Colonel Brimp. I might have taken A Matter of Life and Death, because that is my favourite film, but it's probably better for me to write about my second favourite film, because if it's my favourite thing, I can't really tell you why. I just get all confused. I was very bad at school debating for motions that I believed in. I'm a natural politician. I'm very convincing when I know I'm completely lying and everything is evil and wrong. It's like, it's really easy. And it was more interesting in a way to find out why I was ambivalent, or why I find it a very sad film. I can't actually watch it very often because it just makes me terribly sad, but in a lovely way. Basically I was just told to. It's the same with bullfighting. I was told to write about bullfighting.
Just to continue on that theme, I know that I share with you the anger of lazy journalism, which says that all things you write in fiction must clearly be autobiographical, which is sort of denying that people could ever make things up. In the two non-fiction books you've written, On Bullfighting and The Life of Death of Colonel Blimp, you've also put yourself very much there as a character, where you could have written more abstractly about those things. I mean, was that a deliberate thing? And did you find there was a temptation to fictionalise yourself?
No, it's odd. I make lots of jokes about being, brought up as a Calvinist. But I was, and it does alter you, because you end up with some kind of weird morality, which only applies to typing in my case. But I don't see why you would read an extended piece of non-fiction if the
across from writing it refused to be present. I think in journalism it's entirely appropriate and necessary that you should be kind of absent other than this kind of journalistic voice. But it just felt not correct for a relationship with the reader in the way that it feels not correct to not make things up if I'm writing fiction. I just would feel very uncomfortable confusing them. So I, all of the non-fiction I'm present at some level, almost as a kind of exercise to say, you know, I'm aware that I'm wasting your time and taking up your mental energy, and the least I can do is sort of say, you know, to introduce myself. It's the same with poetry. I write very, very little poetry, but I can't write made-up poetry. I mean, I can't write poetry at all, really, but the paragraphs that I produce are all autobiographical.
And it's interesting you say that both non-fiction books were commissions that were given to you. Is there anything that you would hope to write about yourself independently that's non-fiction?
There are lots of essays I would like to write, which I could probably make people commission me to do. I don't have a big... there are people I really like, there are periods that I really enjoy.
For example?
Everything really, but I don't want to spoil them by staring at them for that long. I would rather take the spirit of bits of them and have it kind of inspire what I'm doing or how I am. Or I always try, and even when I have to research something, I mean, I wrote about Cyrano de Bergerac. I was fascinated by him, and he ended up being a character in a fictional book, but everything that he does and says, I hope, would be something that was not offensive to him. Which is why I'm withdrawing from the film that they're making, because they've just decided to put it in America and do appalling things, and they won't get him right either, and I kind of feel that I'm representing the dead on that thing.
Is that a film of So I Am Glad that's coming?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that now isn't going to happen. Because I won't let it. Because you know, he's a fantastic writer. Nobody knows who he is, and everybody thinks that he's just a character in a play or a character in a movie. And I mean, he was a writer, a very good writer. With him, I've tried to be truthful to what I would have thought his reality would be, but in a fictional setting. But partly in a fictional setting because he loved putting himself in fictional settings. Most of his writing is, you know, he goes to the moon, or he goes to the sun, or he's taken away by witches, or it's lovely stuff.
I think the great thing about that book is that it doesn't really matter how he got there, and it doesn't matter how he goes. There's no need for the explanation.
I tried to explain it, and it doesn't work if you explain it. It's like the difference between Nikita and the American version. If they try and make it realistic, it's like, because it isn't realistic. It just happens.
Well, certainly something else which people try to do with your writing is to label it as Scottish or women's or Scottish women's, all of the above. I mean, does it really annoy you when people try to categorise it in that way, or does it really just sort of pass you by?
I don't meet these people very often. God bless you. No, it's annoying if you get... I don't forced to do things because of it, or you're just assumed to have a set of opinions that you don't have. Or if people have an idea that you should only write about X, Y, and Z because you're X age, or Y gender, or B nationality, which is just really silly. But it doesn't affect me very much because I don't hang out with book reviewers that much.
Sure.
It affects the marketing of the books, but the marketing of my books is not usually that silly. Because I think if they put me into the boxes that they would be very tempted to put me into, I just wouldn't sell very much because I don't really correspond with those boxes. So actually the marketing of the books is just hugely problematic and doesn't work, but that's more fun.
Do you read much that is claimed to be Scottish literature? Are you a fan of it?
I just read books I like. So I like books from all over the place. I very rarely remember the name of who I've read. I mean, if I really love somebody, I try and read their entire oeuvre. But I'll forget the titles of the books. And if I read anybody. But I'm not reading them because they're Scottish. I'm reading them because they're good.
Sure.
Because a lot of the Scots are like a lot of the Russians, are like a lot of the Germans, are like a lot of the Italians. It doesn't make sense to describe somebody who's writing fiction, maybe particularly novels. It's such a long, intimate thing that you do with the reader. You're knowing a person as an individual, or you're hearing a voice as a specific, intimate experience. It's like having a very close, dear friend. You wouldn't describe them as, this is my Jewish, gay, Scottish person. You don't do that. It's like, this is my very dear friend. By the way, he's left-handed, and maybe the other stuff would come up, and maybe it's not relevant. Your primary thing is this is a human being talking to another human being. And I do get very annoyed when people make it about stuff other than that. Because I think it's got a very humanitarian influence to put yourself in the mind of somebody else. And to know that other people are as human as you are. And as soon as you put in the categories, you're saying that they're not.
I mean, in the latest book, Everything You Need, even the dog gets a voice, actually. It's something that, going right back to Looking for the Possible Dunce, that you've always done unusual things with language and with the words on the page. In Everything You Need also, of course, you have the novel within the novel, which is written in a very, very different tone, written by one of the characters. Are there experiments that you've done or would think of doing that haven't worked out? And is there anyone that you kind of model these things on?
They're not really experiments. I mean, the dog talks because you have to like the dog, because I fully intended to kill it. And then when I got to the point where I was going to kill it, I'd written about it and given it a voice and enjoyed it so much, and it was a really nice dog, then I couldn't kill it. And all of the feedback from my publishers was about the dog. It wasn't about, what a lovely novel, what finely honed characters. It was, oh, I'm so glad the dog didn't die. Emails from obscure publicity people that you'd never heard of. Glad about the dog. They should have put the marketing more in the dog area, actually. Like dogs? Here's a big book with bits of dog in it. It wasn't really an experiment, it was just a necessity, because you have to like dogs, so I will, yes. And the same thing, the novel within the novel, because the novel was primarily about a middle-aged, obsessive, kind of intellectually overbearing novelist, and he was writing novel during the course of my writing the novel, his novel was bound to get into my novel because he's that kind of guy. It's just to do with his personality.
And you saw it as the funny, and I presume you mean it to be funny. And you mentioned in relation to the Colonel Blimp story, you were kind of aware that the reader was, you wasted their time. And how far are you interested in in the writing and in the actual process of it, in entertaining the reader and entertaining yourself and writing for yourself? And if there's a two going on, can you talk about the balance between the two?
Yeah, I mean, the aim is to try and get the balance right. No, I'm aware that the things that interest me are usually depressing, frightening, revolting. Yeah, I don't find them that, but other people might. But there are also things that are quite funny. My personal response quite often to being very angry or being very scared or being very revolted myself is humour. I use defensive humour a great deal. So it's partly just me running up and down the page going, like me, please. Like there's a huge funny bit, well, a page and a half of funny in the first novel, which is quite near the beginning, which is to give you a false impression that the rest of the novel will be entertaining. It's not. That's the only funny bit, and it is me going, like me, it's my first novel, help. So it's partly that, but I know that it's necessary to feel that. I mean, when I'm, it kind of cheers me up when I'm writing it. I am the first reader, and if it's getting too kind of, because the overriding message of all of it is everybody will die.
Apart from the dog.
Yeah, it doesn't, well, eventually that'll die as well, you know. And it doesn't really fly as a thing that people want to be reminded of, because it's true. So you have to sort of do glove puppets and stuff, and every now and then go, you all die. And that you have to do it that way. So it's kind of the way, I mean, I notice with myself and with my friends, we have a very dark sense of humour. I remember seeing, I don't know if people saw Jam, the Chris Morris series, which had terribly bad trailers. It looked like a horrible Ponzi kind of art programme, and it was actually just very, very sick. There are bits of that when I thought, oh my God, somebody is not well as me, hey. But probably as angry. I would hope to entertain, but just not just to entertain. I'd be very upset if I was just writing froth. But it's quite unlikely. bloody kind of post-drowning froth. And I do have an obsessive interest in anatomy, and of course I've indulged it by going and seeing dead bodies and hanging out with anatomists, and then you have a very strange idea of your body after a while, because you're aware of, you know, how it looks when it's sliced diagonally, and it's just, which is fascinating. The body is a beautiful thing in all its parts, at which point I mustn't tell all you examples of how beautiful it is, that always makes people ill, but you know, as the time goes by, you're aware that you have certain areas of interest which are all more and more alarming, so they have to be softened, and I have a sick sense of humour, really, and I get very angry, and I can't, again, I can't rant and have anybody listen to me, particularly when you're doing the whole intimate thing and you're reading and you're just last thing at night, and you don't want me jumping up and down going, oh my God, bloody politicians, because, you know, you're going to throw the book away. And there are other ways of saying that, and that there are more constructive ways of saying that, or ways that work better, which far better people than me use. The opening of our mutual friend, which again is everybody dies, which you all know because you're all university top people, full of learning.
You might need to remind them.
Yes. Rowing down the River Thames, poor little Cockney girl rowing down the River Thames with her poor little Cockney father, and they make their living, you know, dragging dead people out of the Thames and taking all their stuff. And the primary thing that he's, well, in my opinion, because I'm obsessed with death, the primary thing that he's doing, or one of the nicest things that he's doing, is this is what it's like in a book about facades. I mean, there's a family in it called the Veneerings. You know, it's like there's accumulating stuff and there's thinking about important things. There's stuff and there's you're going to die. Where's your stuff go? And the opening of it is that they have this dead body and they empty its pockets. Which is such a violation if you're alive, because if you're dead, it's like, who cares? We get your stuff. And just that, you know, the spare change out of your pocket is such a personal thing. But it's not your spare change anymore, because you don't exist. It's very beautifully done. And again, it's, you die. But in a very nice way.
I think we've got time for one more question, if there's one. Yes.
Could you talk a bit about the difference in the process for you of writing short stories and writing
novels? It's a mystery.
continuing mystery.
The scene you read could have been the opening of a much longer text. And I'm just wondering how you knew that that was finished as opposed to being the start of something much longer.
Sort of by feel. And one of the things, if a short story is remotely working, is it should sort of be resonating out with itself, so it looks as if you could make it into a novel, but actually if you did another line it would all go pancaked. After a while there was a lessening of my own personal terror, which prevented me from contemplating ideas that were of any size. I mean, the first short story that I seriously thought, I will write this to the best of my ability to make it the best short story that I can write, to see if I can. And obviously there's the huge chasm of, if I've tried my absolute best and I can't, then I can't do it. And I'll be unemployed forever. Or actually a children's puppeteer forever, which is what I was doing. Because it suited my personality so well. It's actually horrible. It's probably why I'm such a nasty person. It's why so many Punch and Judy men are drunks, because it's an evil job. Abandoned children when you're in a booth with your hands up, little fluffy things. You're powerless and it's evil. So I was trying my best to write. It's a terribly small short story, and almost nothing happens, and there's almost nobody in it. Because I was just terrified to bring in anything that would actually confuse me. So it's like this little tiny, so it's really a poem stretched. And then when the first book of short stories was published, that was so weird and unlikely that I'd had a longer idea which felt as if it might be a novel. And I allowed it to kind of creep out, and it kept elongating. And then as time has gone by, probably one of the only things that gets easier is that you recognize in the first place that you've got enough critical mass to begin writing anything at all and not just marking time and producing nonsense. And then this is a critical mass which is a short story. I've only got it wrong once with Original Bliss, which turned into a novella. I thought it was a long short story, and I very quickly discovered that something was happening to me that had not happened before, because it has the intensity of a short story but demands an enormous length and just horribly tiring thing. I didn't feel like anything else I've written, apart from maybe screenplays, because they demand this intensity and all of the narrative stuff kind of gets thrown out. So that's very tiring. But it is a feel thing. It's not a describable thing, because you could write down all of the elements of a short story, and my short stories now, I've probably read one of the shortest ones in the book in its entirety. I mean, they're 30-page short stories now, but they aren't novels. They don't have enough to be novels. And apart from anything else, do I want to be with these principal characters for a year of my life? Or would it drive me stark, staring mad? And would I kill them all? And with Everything You Need, I mean, there are people in Everything You Need that I just really liked. And I'm going to cheat and bring one of them back, actually, because he is appropriate for the next novel that I'll do. But I love him. And the dog's quite fun. But it'll be crippled by... That's the thing, I didn't kill it, but it'll be crippled for life. It'll have a gammy leg and horrible rheumatism, and it's just, you know, I would have been better to kill it. But, yeah, can I bear to travel with these people and this thing for a year, year and a half, and to continue to be surprised by it? But that'll happen maybe over 5 years, that I'll get that kind of accumulation of bits.
Just incredibly quickly, because we're into our last 2 minutes or so, and just ask, because this year you've got due out, as well as the book of short stories, there's a radio play, a television series. Is there anything else that I've missed, apart from general journalism and judging the Orange Book Prize that involves you reading 48 novels? And
Well, that'd be right, and I'd be starting to write a novel.
So do you do things concurrently, or do you finish one piece and then immediately start another? Because there's such a prodigious output you've got.
No, I have to do together. But partly it's deadlines. I have to write another 3 hours of television between now and the end of March, because it has to be
in pre-production by July.
Do you find the deadlines make it easier for you to write?
Any television film, I'll only do it with people that I like, which means I don't do very much or I walk out. And this is with Canadians, so they're nice. They're lovely, and it's with... I know the actors because we've already done 6 hours, and the actors are just astonishing. Aidan Killen, that was in Queer as Folk. There's a guy called Martin Cummins. If you've ever seen Poltergeist the Legacy, he's in it, but he's very bad because he has no lines. He's just a pullover. And if anybody needs to be, if a phantom needs to be subdued in a physical way, he comes and subdues them. But he's astonishingly good. He's got, you know, a Canadian equivalent of an Emmy. I mean, he's just amazing. So, I mean, writing the next 6 hours of that is it's great, because all you're doing is trying to get Aidan Gillen and Martin Cummins in the same room. And I've just done episode 3, where that's all they do is have these nice, and you just know they can both, you know, I could be writing out entries from the telephone book, because they would make them look good. But that's to hear voices and to come from being a novelist. I remember the first time I did a television thing, and the bad guy who was really nice was being played by Peter Mullen before he was expensive. And he just did this thing where he leant along, he was playing an evil redcoat in a Scottish Jacobite thing, wearing a very bad wig because it was the BBC and we couldn't afford wigs. So the two wigs that existed were both sort of Shirley Temple, or at least there was Shirley Temple and there was Groucho Marx, Harpo Marx, and it was just was very bad. But he leant along this mantelpiece in an evil way. He just did evil leaning. Great, he just was fantastic. He was completely evil. It was really arrogant, evil, slimy leaning on mantelpiece. And it's just, you know, I didn't have to write any of that. Didn't even suggest that he would go near the mantelpiece. Didn't know if we could afford a mantelpiece. And I, you know, actors do that. They just add all that stuff, and it's great. Because if you're, you know, within the novel, you have to write the music, you have to write the lighting, you have to write the mantelpiece, you have to write them, you do that, what they think, and with that, you just give the line, and mantelpiece, evil leaning, all hands.
That's good. I wish we could continue, but I'm afraid the clock's against us. So, ladies and gentlemen, would you please thank A.L. Kennedy?